From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. President Donald Trump this week announced the release of a lengthy set of rules that critics say gives the religious right more cover to discriminate against women and minority groups based on their personal beliefs. The document, coming ironically from the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Civil Rights, is 440 pages in length and was announced by Trump at the White House during the National Day of Prayer on Thursday. The rules include allowing healthcare workers from refusing to offer services such as abortion and sterilization. We turn to Rob Boston, Director of Communications at the group Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Welcome, Rob.
Thanks for having me on, Sonali.
So first, I understand that these rules are called, they're called rules of conscience or conscience rules. This is part, of course, of the long-standing religious rights attempt to define their religious freedom as, constitutionally protected religious freedom as something so broad that it impacts the rights of others, right?
That's right. You know, historically, religious freedom has been interpreted as your right to worship or not, as you see fit, to join in worship with others, to read religious books, to pass that on to your children. But religious freedom has never been interpreted as a device to allow one person to take away the rights of another or to interfere with that person's private health decisions. So this really is, in our perspective, a radical redefinition of the very idea of religious freedom.
So I understand, of course, very early in his presidency, in early 2019, Trump signed an executive order that he called Free Speech and Religious Liberty. And this set of rules that was released builds upon that executive order?
Well, this has been something that we've grappled with for a long time as a nation, to the extent that you want to grant these types of so-called conscience objections. And there were rules and procedures under the Obama administration, but of course the Trump administration has been systematically dismantling all the rules and regulations from the previous administration. And they've been doing this largely at the behest of the religious right. Religious right organizations favor an extremely broad interpretation of conscience that would allow people to really, I think, interfere with medical decisions that are best left with the patient and his or her doctors. But instead, we're seeing this situation where pretty much anybody can, in the medical field, can interject themselves into that relationship. And that includes the receptionist who's answering the phone, someone who may be handling some insurance paperwork, even custodians and people in support services. It's a very broad set of rules. And I think it, far from adding clarity, it just confuses the issue.
What basis is the Trump administration putting these laws, out as? I mean, isn't this something that Congress should be deciding? I mean, how is the president unilaterally deciding that people have the right to discriminate?
Well, that's a very good question. There are certain policies whereby the government can issue rules and regulations, and federal departments can do that, and of course, the president does have the power under some circumstances to issue executive orders. But what we're really seeing during the Trump era is an unprecedented grab by the executive office to expand those powers pretty widely. Because Congress, at least one chamber of it right now, is in the hands of the Democrats, the president isn't able really to get legislation through. So instead, they're trying this regulatory route. I mean, think about this for a minute. This is a 440-page document. It's as long as the Mueller report. So it's just this incredibly huge and dense document that this department has issued. And when that filters down to sort of the average person working in the healthcare industry, what do you think their ability to synthesize that and put it into action is going to be? I mean, we have lawyers that have spent days looking at this, trying to sort through it and figure out what it says. The average healthcare worker is not going to be able to do that. And I think what's going to happen is they're just going to assume that they have rights that they may not have, and start denying people services.
The word abortion appears 135 times in this document. As far as you can tell, what does this document do on, or what does it allow people to do or allow them to not do where abortion is concerned?
Well, you know, there are already certain laws and regulations that cover conscience rights in abortion, but those covered, you know, doctors and nurses. Now we're seeing a kind of a radical expansion of that policy to people working in very tangential areas of healthcare. I think, you know, you're talking about people whose main job is paperwork or people who may be involved in transporting patients, this sort of thing. It's really designed to just broadly push that exemption as much as it can. I think that this is really an attempt by the administration to undermine abortion rights because the courts have not yet taken the step of overturning Roe versus Wade, which of course is what many conservatives would like. I think it's what President Trump is working toward with his extremely conservative appointments to the Supreme Court. But since they don't have that ruling in hand yet, they're just trying to chip away at it and put as many obstacles in the place of it as they can. And unfortunately, I think they've been pretty successful.
There's also assisted suicide and sterilization, which is something that there's a lot of worry over and that this document spells out rules for. Can you explain that a little bit? I mean, assisted suicide, I'm assuming they're worried about the growing number of states that are now allowing people to take charge of their own fate, if you will, you know, based on if they happen to have a terminal disease?
Yes, exactly. We are seeing that movement start to spread in the states. And in some cases, people are sort of taking matters into their own hands by putting, you know, ballot referenda questions on. And the polls show that there is support there for people having more determination over what happens to them with their end of life care when they're facing illnesses that will inevitably be fatal. But there's great resistance to that among the religious right, among the Roman Catholic hierarchy. It's kind of the flip side of the abortion issue. Just as they want to be able to control how women can give birth and under what circumstances, they also want to control what happens to folks at the end of their lives. And they are looking for ways to interfere in that relationship too. So these rules are designed, again, to put more barriers, more obstacles in the way of people's rights to be able to make a decision about what happens to them at the end of their lives. And again, that is something that really ought to be discussed between the patient, his or her doctor, and relevant family members. But instead, these rules set up a framework whereby absolute strangers can step in and interfere in that process.
I understand that the document doesn't explicitly mention LGBTQ Americans, but what do you worry could be the impact on that specific minority?
Well, if you think about the most kind of conservative religious elements in our society right now, they obsess over a couple issues. One we've already talked about is abortion. But LGBTQ rights is the other one, always looking for ways to cause harms to members of that community, to take away their rights, to refuse to serve them. We see that in the context of businesses. Now it's being extended to healthcare. You think about if somebody's transgender and they need trans-affirming medical care. Again, suddenly you've got people who can start interfering with that. The right of a same-sex couple who may be legally married to seek healthcare for a child or to engage in fertility treatments, this sort of thing. People can come into this relationship and just start interfering on the basis of their religious beliefs, which may be grounded in bigotry or ignorance, what have you. And that's really what concerns us, is these really are matters that are best left for the people most affected. And instead, you're going to have these strangers coming in and just gumming up the works.
Contraception is another big issue. And there's, of course, been a legal history of whether women have the right to get contraceptive coverage from insurance companies. Contraception is not even anything close to abortion. And yet, of course, the religious right has such trouble with allowing women to simply be able to control their fertility. What is this document? How would this impact contraception coverage?
Yeah, it really is amazing when you think about that issue. I mean, this is something we thought we had nailed down. in 1965 when the U.S. Supreme Court declared that adults have the right to use birth control and that state laws that attempted to make it illegal or gag doctors for even talking about it, those laws were declared unconstitutional in 1965. Yet here we are, 2019, and the religious right groups and some of their allies in the conservative Catholic community have been given this new powerful tool to, again, interfere in a relationship between a doctor and his or her patient. We're seeing that with the contraceptive access, situations where pharmacists have suddenly said, well, I don't care if you have a prescription from your doctor. I'm not going to give you this medication. I'm not going to issue it. It's just astounding because the vast majority of Americans, if you look at the polling data on this question, see contraceptives as absolutely non-controversial and support the right of access. And in fact, that's the one thing that actually has been shown to reduce the abortion rate in this country. Is
to reduce the need
available.
For abortions and unplanned pregnancies in the first place.
Exactly. Yet the same people who are so adamantly anti-abortion are now, many of them, trying to block access to contraceptives. It's astounding.
Right. Because in the end, of course, it's about controlling women's bodies. Isn't there a history in this country, a very ugly history of using religious and moral beliefs as a cover for straight up discrimination, specifically against Black people and other racial minorities?
Yes, we certainly saw some of that in the Jim Crow era in the South. There were people who made their argument for discrimination on explicitly religious grounds. Well, the Bible says there shall not be any race mixing. And that's why we're not going to allow interracial marriage, or we're not going to allow people to stay in a certain hotel or eat in a restaurant or be in our public institutions like schools and libraries and swimming pools, all this sort of thing. Now, not all of that was grounded in religious belief in Jim Crow South. You know, some people were just old-fashioned bigots. But there were folks who made that argument. We thought we eradicated that with the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Yet here we are many years later, grappling with some of these same issues again, a little bit of a different stage, but really the same issues, people arguing that because of their religious beliefs, they should be able to exclude services to an entire class of individuals. It's absolutely astounding.
Isn't there an argument to be made that these rules that Trump released on Thursday violate the Civil Rights Act and the protections that people have under that act and other acts?
Well, I certainly think that there are many issues like that that are very compelling. And, you know, when you have something like this happening that's so complicated, so lengthy, so dense, that even, you know, lawyers have to spend days wading through it, we're going to have to see how the dust settles. But obviously, a lot of people are not going to be very happy about these regulations and look at them as a violation of their fundamental rights. And I think they'll take appropriate action from there.
Now, just the fact that this set of rules was released during the National Day of Prayer at the White House is something that I think we should discuss as well, right? What position does your organization take on the fact that we have in this country, where there's supposed to be a separation of church and state, the President of the United States holding a National Day of Prayer? That, you know, although I think technically rabbis and people of other non-Christian faiths are encouraged to attend, is primarily the sort of exercise in affirming the sort of Christian nature of the nation?
Yes, exactly. It's definitely a concern of ours. This National Day of Prayer is something that goes back to the 1950s. Now, so many of these things that we call civil religion, under God being inserted into the Pledge of Allegiance, in God we trust, being named the national motto, even the law codifying and stamping "In God We Trust" on our currency, those all go back to the 1950s and the epic struggle with godless communism, you know, that we went under. National Day of Prayer dates back to that as well. It used to be a floating holiday. It was codified in 1988 as the first Thursday in May. And I do have problems with it. You know, we don't need a directive from the president or a governor or a mayor or anybody else to tell us how to pray, when to pray, or whether we even should pray. That decision is best left to the individual conscience of every American. And some people, many people will pray, others will decide that's not for them and they won't do it. One of the problems I have with this whole National Day of Prayer is that the obvious message being sent to people is that you ought to be praying. That's the good thing to do. That's what real Americans do. What kind of message does that send to the non-believer, the skeptic, or the non-Christian? Because as you point out, you know, despite a little patina of interfaith gloss that gets put on these events, they're often overtly Christian in their approach, and they're really not open to members of other faiths. They're not as welcoming as they ought to be.
And of course, these protections or so-called right to, protections and what we would say is more along the lines of our right to discriminate, generally are understood to apply to largely Christian groups, right? One can only imagine a conservative Muslim saying that, all right, in that case, I too will take the right to, apply Sharia law, whatever, the same kinds of things that a lot of these right-wing Christians say they are fearful of taking over the United States. This set of rules doesn't apply to extremists in other religions, does it?
Well, that's the irony of this. You know, I monitor these religious right groups quite a bit for my job, and, you know, they're always screaming about Sharia law and the takeover and people being forced to live under these versions of religious law. And that's really not happening anywhere. I mean, there have actually been states that have passed laws attempting to ban, Sharia, and there's no evidence of this even happening. But what we are seeing, ironically, is the effort to impose fundamentalist Christian law on all of us.
It's a Christian version of Sharia. It's a Christian Taliban.
Yes, exactly. And a very extreme fundamentalist version that actually even millions of American Christians who are liberal or progressive would reject. They're the ones trying to control our reproductive freedom, our sexuality, and to some extent, what material we can access and what we're exposed to. This is the type of power they used to have many years ago. They had all this control, and we have slowly chipped away and pulled their grip off of our necks, and they want to get that back. And I really think that's the thing we really need to be focusing on. This isn't just about a 440-page directive that the Health and Human Services Department issued. Yes, that's important, but it is part of a larger plan by these folks to basically reassert as much power as they can, as much control as they can over our private lives, our religious lives, our sex lives, our reproductive lives, and the role of women in society. And we have got to fight that every step of the way.
Now, of course, shouldn't the fact that this specific community is relying on Trump as the arbiter of morality really take away from any standing that they have? I mean, how is Trump, even remotely considered a moral figure?
We are living in the strangest times, Sonali, I have to tell you. I see some things that just, they're unbelievable. You would think they were a parody. People seriously arguing that Trump has been anointed by God to lead this nation. He's God's chosen figure. He's risen up, blessed by God. Just things that really ought to be considered blasphemous by a lot of Christians, I would imagine. This is a man, I try not to make judgments about the depth of anybody else's religious sincerity, because you don't really oftentimes know what's in someone's heart, but sometimes you do because of their behavior. And certainly in the case of Trump, the morality is just not anywhere near the level that you would think that the religious right would celebrate, yet there they are. It's a strictly political arrangement. They're the one faction that has been sticking with him through all these troubles. 81% voted for him in the election, conservative white evangelicals, and that hasn't really wavered or dropped despite all we've been through as a nation since then. And he's paying them back. It's just political tit for tat.
And it's amazing that that calculation is so out there and so in the open, by a group that is claiming they have the moral high ground, resorting to essentially something that is so much in violation of ethical standards or morality. And it just shows a deep hypocrisy. So I'm hoping that that your organization or other groups, I'm assuming that there's going to be some sort of legal response to this 440-page set of rules?
Well, as I said, our attorneys are poring over the document. It is quite lengthy. It's extremely complicated. It's extremely dense. So we'll see what happens there. But I do think that there is going to be a strong pushback to this, whether it takes place in the courts or just in the arena of public opinion or other venues, and especially when these stories start to come in. And we're hearing some already. I mean, during the pharmacist business we talked about earlier, there were very compelling stories that came forth of people being denied medication that they needed, and as people are denied medical service that they're needed. I think that that's going to make a difference. And the tide of public opinion, which I think is already on our side, will continue to strongly crest. And I'm hoping that will help us just get us back to some semblance of sanity, because we have really, in many ways, taken religious freedom, which is an extremely important concept in this country. Don't get me wrong. But we've turned it on its head. And that has to stop.
So it's one thing for an individual pharmacist to say, well, I'm not going to fill your birth control prescription, because one could conceivably go to the next pharmacist and get it done if one needed, even though that shouldn't be the case. But it's another thing for, say, a health insurance company to make a denial, or an entire, you know, clinic or hospital or institution. Does this document give cover to, you know, beyond individuals?
Well, I haven't been reading it. Our attorneys have been reading it. But I think certainly an argument can be made like that, because if you can extrapolate what some of the business owners have done in the healthcare arena, remember there were firms like Hobby Lobby and some of these other firms that said, we're not going to cover contraceptives for anybody. And that was it. It's done. And that was because of the religious beliefs of the owner of the company. So if you extrapolate from there, yeah, we've definitely got a problem on our hands with one individual basically making a decision that affects potentially thousands of people, if not more.
And so finally, do you hope that there is enough sentiment among Americans to counter this? I mean, we, like it or not, are a very religious nation. Most Americans don't question the interweaving of, you know, the words God in, you know, things like the Pledge of Allegiance and other things. And we sort of take it for granted. Is there an appetite to push back? There's certainly, you know, we certainly know that abortion rights are popular. A majority of Americans support women's right to choose whether or not they want to have an abortion. But on these sorts of rules, especially given how obscure and technical they are, and this lengthy set of documents, I'm wondering if there is a public appetite to fight it.
I hope so. I mean, I do think that one thing Americans have said loud and clear is that they're concerned about their health care, and they find the system to be, you know, not very responsive as it is. So to be putting additional roadblocks or barriers in the way of people's ability to access care, that is a very serious thing. We already have enough of those. I mean, if you think about the gatekeepers we have right now before you can get your health care, there's enough of them out there. Allowing somebody to come in and add more on about grounds of religion, I hope that that's going to wake people up. But sometimes, I mean, it pains me to say this, sometimes things have to really get bad before people realize this is serious and start to fight back. And some rights have to be lost or put in jeopardy to get folks to realize the seriousness of the issue. I take no pleasure in saying that, but that may be where we are.
Rob, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Give out a website where people can find out more about the work you do.
Absolutely. Just reach us at au.org. Very simple, au.org. And you can find out all about what we're doing there and how to interact with us on social media as well.
We'll post a link to that from our website. Thanks, Rob.
Thank you.
My guest has been Rob Boston, Director of Communications at Americans United for Separation of Church and State. We've been discussing Trump's announced rules enabling discrimination. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.